So our next speaker, as Fabio has mentioned before, the coffee break comes from Hungary. She has a PhD in translational studies from Eötvös Loránd University, and she has been working at University of Jyväskylä since 2011 at the Language Center, teaching academic language and communication skills for bachelor's and master's students, as well as research writing for doctoral students. And she will give us a bit of insight into open science. Enjoy.
All right. Can you hear me? All right. Hopefully you are all refreshed after the coffee break. And as Orsi mentioned, I'm kind of an outsider here because I don't say I don't have anything to do with psychology, because I am interested in psychology, especially the language aspect. But as Orsi said, I'm from the Language Center, so this presentation is going to be a little bit different from the previous one because it's not focusing on the content, so not psychology, but something that is definitely relevant for all of you, because you are going to be future scientists, researchers. I just wonder, before I start the presentation, you can see the main themes that we are going to cover. I just wonder how many of you have ever attended an open science course in your studies? Okay, that's good. At least it's a good sign, because it should definitely be an integral part of PhD students' programs and the studies. But anyway, even if you have attended, probably, hopefully, I'm going to say something new. And also, I would like you to share your thoughts. So I try to make this presentation interactive. So if you have anything you want to comment or add or ask, feel free. But of course, at the very end, I'll try to reserve around half an hour for discussion questions. So I do have some concrete questions that I would like you to discuss at the very end. Can you hear me well, by the way? Okay. All right. So let's start. Have you ever heard anything about this man? Any of you? Okay, his name, as you can see, is Aaron Swartz, and if you look at the date of birth and the date of death, something probably strikes you, that he died at the age of 26. And why I wanted to start the presentation with his picture is because he is considered to be one of the so to say, heroes of the open science movement, because he originally wanted to fight for good, fight for open research, open science, but again, he bumped into certain obstacles because he actually did illegal things, and actually his whole work, his whole life illuminated the problems today that researchers often faced before the open access became a little bit more common. So the problem was that he downloaded a massive number of articles from JSTOR, the database, probably you know, and then those articles were, of course, not open access when he did that, so he committed technically a crime. It was illegal. And then he was actually also involved in the development of Reddit and Creative Commons, so he did quite a lot to achieve something meaningful, at least. He was also considered to be a genius by his professors. He was also studying at Harvard University. And then, actually, at the age of 26, after he was prosecuted and there was a $1 million penalty fine waiting for him and also 35 years in prison, so he decided to hang himself, and then he actually died. He was said to suffer from depression, so you as psychologists, that's probably also an interesting thing. If somebody, because he actually showed early signs of depression, all his professors and friends and family members knew about it. So another question, an additional question is, could it have been prevented or something like that? But anyway, I wanted to start with that. And the first quote that you can see is from the so-called Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto that he co-authored. And if you read these words, you can see exactly what kind of summarizes the open science movement, not just open access, but open science movement. Especially in the third line, this term, the privatization of knowledge, because this is something that still characterizes academic research, especially the publication aspects. You probably know about it, but we are going to go a little bit more into more detail. And the second quote is by the European Commission. And actually, if you look at the date, the first one, the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto was written in 2008, and this second, it's a European Commission report, was written in 2009, so 1 year difference. And that's why I wanted to use Aaron Swartz's life to illustrate that probably, according to many experts, actually his life gave a lot of impetus, a bit of momentum to this open science movement. But of course, the term open science has always existed because science inherently is open because people publish the results. But of course, there are certain issues that even though results are published, there are issues. So actually, I highlighted some phrases in the second quote. And I think it's really important to emphasize that this whole open science movement is not just about changing or choosing certain strategies and tools and mechanisms, but it's also a change in the whole culture of doing science or making science, and also the practice, the everyday practice of researchers. You're going to be researchers. So actually, it's very important that you understand the underlying philosophies and principles, because the more you can identify with the whole movement, the easier it is to do these certain things that are signs of open science, not just because it's required by funding agencies or universities, but also because you believe in it. So this slide, actually, a little bit vague, but hopefully you can see these are actually the main stakeholders if we talk about scientific research. And as you can see, of course, some of the roles overlap because universities can also be policymakers, at least within their own institution. But anyway, you can see that the open science includes a lot of parties, and then sometimes the interests clash. Sorry, can you tell me which two parties' interests clash the most? So where is the most conflict? Any ideas? Yeah? Publishers and? Publishers, even the public? Uh-huh, okay. Yeah? Publishers and researchers in what sense? Okay, so technically you're writing an article for free. You offer your services, so to say, for the public good. And then if you think about the reviewer's perspective, those who judge the quality of your writing, the peer review, in the peer review process, the reviewers are also doing their... Are they paid? No, typically they are doing it out of dedication, prestige, whatnot. So the funny thing is that the most important... parties involved are doing their work free, but the publishers still ask for money, so they are selling this. So it's a big market, and there are, of course, many, many issues. Of course, it's always important to listen to their arguments. Why do they ask for money? But anyway, this is a complicated issue. All right. So these are actually some of the main driving forces. Yeah? Sorry? Publishers, researchers, at least one clash, but of course, somebody mentioned the public also, because the interested public typically don't have access to scientific articles, so you might have to ask for some friends who are university students too. But again, the researcher's responsibility when they popularize, their accumulated knowledge, that's another issue that we are going to cover. So that can help the interested public to have access to more scientific knowledge. Okay, some of them, the driving forces, and of course we can cover, this is just some of them. Of course, if you think about today's problems, especially in the fields of psychology, I think the idea of cross-disciplinary collaboration is very important, and also these projects are a good example of not just interdisciplinary, but also intercultural collaboration. So that is very important, probably because these societal challenges are even more. And somebody mentioned, actually, this issue of bilingual kids and their language development. And I was thinking that I myself am a mother. My son is 3 years old, and I speak to him in Hungarian. My husband is American, so he speaks to him in English. But we live in Finland, so he goes to Finnish daycare. So in that case, the language development, something that I'm really genuinely interested in, what's going on here and what might be the risks, the dangers. So in that case, of course, different cultural perspectives are also important, and of course, different languages. And then one big argument is also because there is this gap between research and society, exactly the issue that we have just mentioned. And of course, we have this huge technological development, and many people argue that we still don't harness it properly or efficiently. So especially if you think about the development of social web technologies. So that's something that allows a lot of more effective and efficient collaboration. And then again, the societal impact, because if you hear this word impact, probably all of us first think about the research impact, the scientific impact, because what you publish is important for other researchers, of course, from the same field or from different fields, but also there is this societal impact. What do you think it refers to? How can you measure the impact of, let's say, an article, how it influences society? Okay. So this is actually, especially in the field of psychology, I think this societal impact is probably more evident than in, let's say, philosophy, because whatever you publish will have direct relevance to practice, to practitioners, and also on the life of children to make their lives better. So this kind of practical issues always become important. But we are going to go into more detail there. And then number five, this access to publicly funded knowledge. So one of the main arguments is that the creation of knowledge and especially dissemination of knowledge is not necessarily democratic. Today, there are big differences between countries and in terms of access to knowledge. And also managing funding research projects. So anyway, the democratic principle is one of the underlying principles. And especially if you look at this excerpt from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from 1948, you can see it's highlighted that people have the right to share in scientific advancement and benefits. So as early as 1948, this principle already became apparent. And still, if you think about what happened between 1948 and 1948, or maybe the millennium, the turn of the millennium, not much, because this open science movement got this big momentum only after the turn of the millennium, I would say, especially around the death of Aaron Swartz, so to say, 2008. Maybe that was a boost to publishers also, we don't know. Some more visual representation of the underlying principles or philosophies, as we mentioned, transparency is probably the most important one, and this transparency refers to the whole research life cycle, so not just the publication process, but the whole process, and we can discuss that in more detail. The universal accessibility of scientific information, collaboration, not only between researchers, but also between researchers and the public, and then the reusability of scientific information, reproducibility, replicability. These are things that especially in psychology are very, very important because you're doing empirical studies. And then the dissemination of scientific knowledge via online tools, so technically utilizing technology and utilizing the internet and all the opportunities that it has to offer. I don't want to go into detail about this slide, just to illustrate how complex this phenomenon is. And there's actually this FOSTER is an EU-funded research group. It's an international research group. They came up with this taxonomy. We can touch upon almost all of these, and also not just in this presentation, but the next one after this one. I just wanted to call your attention to this FOSTER, because their website is actually full of free even courses. If you want to know more about certain aspects of open science, you can find even whole courses. So if you're dedicated enough, you can train yourself even more. So in this article by Fächer and Friesike in 2014, they actually tried to categorize all the streams in the open science discourse, and they came up with these five main categories: the public school, democratic, pragmatic, infrastructure, and measurement school. And then I actually added these two to the side, because this openness of science is also related. Some researchers argue that it's also related to the academic freedom, the concept of academic freedom, how open making science is in a certain country. And then, of course, it's related to political issues as well. And also, if you think about what kinds of research are funded and what are the typical research focuses or foci in, for example, psychology. So the diversity in research topics, in research issues, is also probably an issue that we can add to the open science discourse. Because if there are certain neglected topics, that's a sign that science is not as open in that particular field. And then another one related to the diversity in the research workforce. And one of the most prominent line of research is dedicated to the issue of gender equality. Have you ever thought about this? Because actually there is a slide, I don't want to go into detail, but there is actually in 2015, and as far as I know, these are psychologists, the authors are psychologists, they were researching the situation of women in research in general or in academia, and they came up with originally 7 actionable strategies for advancing women. These are just some of them. If you look at these, because many of you are women here, but of course it also applies to men in certain situations. How do you feel about these ideas? Would it help you?
It would be fun to practice.
Yeah, it's very rare. This is still in its infancy, I think, to try to help women who are also mothers or men who are also fathers at the same time, because doing research is definitely difficult if you are a mother. How many of you are in this situation? Is it true that it makes it a little bit more difficult? Depends, of course, on several things. But anyway, I just wanted to show that there is even research, and maybe if you are a psychologist, you are more interested in these issues. And also gender equality, of course, in certain departments, female representation on academic corporate committees, and also the third one, gender-balanced peer review and speaker selection committees. I think you did a good job because the speakers are all, men and women as well. But anyway, so gender equality is also an issue that can be added to the open science discourse. Yeah? Yeah, of course, the cultural differences, yeah, that is something. And then, of course, if you investigate this from the government's perspective, they need to come up with certain strategies, probably at the national level too. But also universities and institutions are responsible for this, or funding agencies. So it's intertwined with all the aspects. Okay, so let's examine all these schools one by one. The public school, of course, the main argument is that science needs to be more accessible to the public. So those who are not experts, those who are not in academia, average people, average citizens. And the two main lines are accessible research process and comprehensible research result. This accessibility of the research process is probably something that you have heard of. I don't know how many of you have done it. Or have you heard of citizen science? No? As the name suggests, it means that the non-scientists, the amateurs, dedicated amateurs, can also participate in making science. Of course, the big question is at what stage they participate in it. Typically, the criticism is that they have a role that is not necessarily the most meaningful in the whole research, collecting data or kind of assisting in the collection of data. And some people argue that it's a sign of, you know, free workforce, using people instead of using people without any remuneration, or typically they say that it's a one-time event, so not necessarily a long-term involvement of the public. Another one, or maybe within citizen science, there is this crowdfunding as a phenomenon. Have you ever heard of it? Uh-huh. Have you ever participated? Okay, of course it's also in other fields, but in science, actually, it's probably a newer initiative. So the public can contribute money. Actually, there is this site, it's experiment.com, which was founded in 2012. If you check it out, I don't want to click now, but there are several projects, and you can even start your own projects. If you think that you need to raise some money, but you don't want to apply for official grants, then it's actually also good to see what the public is interested in, so what kind of research projects they would support. And then I actually checked, there are some projects in psychology as well, but of course before you start the projects, it undergoes evaluation, so not anybody can start any project. There is some evaluation included. And according to their latest update, 22 articles have already been published that were actually funded by the public, and they raised money through this website. And of course, those who support the project, they get some non-monetary benefits from the project. So in the future, yeah?
I think there is a role that non-scientists play part in the whole research process. I mean, the participants, they are non-scientists, and they are commonly participating voluntarily.
Yeah.
They have children and their families, so they are a big part of the process.
That is true. Yeah.
They cannot go out, they go back home with knowledge. Now, after you explain to them,
That is also a very good point, especially in your field, because in these projects, it's technically the parents' decision whether they participate or not, because it's not the child, typically. So that is a sign of being interested in science and also trying to do and trying to change. And probably they feel that they could also benefit from the results, because it would help them in practice. Good point. Okay. The other one within the public school is the comprehensibility of the research result. So two strands. One of them is the writing style. What do you think about the writing style, the general writing style in psychology? If you read academic articles, how easy is it to understand them? Can you see a sign of the language becoming a little bit more comprehensible or less comprehensible, or are there any differences between different cultures, languages?
Depends a bit on the journal.
Depends on the journal, yeah. That's also an issue. I was always wondering, when you write your dissertation, but we can also discuss that tomorrow, most of you will write it in English, I guess. That's another good discussion topic, why in English, and how many of you are publishing in your mother tongue as well? How many of you have published in your mother tongue? Okay. What was the motivation? I'm just curious. Okay, of course, the relevance. Okay. Because actually, it's really my dissertation was also written in English. And then when I had to present the results and talk about it in a conference in Hungarian, that was really, really difficult. So that can be a problem, actually, if you know everything in English, but you cannot even talk about your research because you don't know the technical terms in your mother tongue. And that can be an issue. So I do suggest publishing also at least one or two articles in your mother tongue. Also advancing the science, you know, keeping the language and making the language up to date, using the terms in your mother tongue. But anyway, going back to English, because English has often been criticized as you know, too difficult to understand, the scientific language at least. Have you ever read an article that was really difficult to process because of the language? Most of them, many of them. Is it actually the vocabulary or something else that makes it? Uh-huh. Because many people say the length of the sentences, the complexity of the sentences, people try to impress the audience by sounding too fancy. And this is something that is changing now. And even reviewers try to recommend using simple, very simple language.
And also the presentation of the results, so it's really more
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, and we can probably get back to that tomorrow, because you also have to think about the audience when you write, and the dissertation is, we can think about who is the dissertation for, and also in some universities there are sections that are the more publicized version. At least in this university, I know there is a summary at the end, written typically in Finnish, so there is a switch in language, the Yhteen veto part, those who are Finnish, and then that is mainly for the general public, so not for the scientific audience. So this is actually really important. But even if it's for the scientific audience, the point is that you should get your message across to the audience, and it's not the language that counts, but it's the message. And the processing time, of course, matters a lot. The less processing time to process the message, the easier it is to understand. And then, so the writing style is one thing, and the other one is these alternative tools for science communication. That is also, there is an overlap, because this is also a big part of one of the other schools. If you think about scientific blogging or Twitter, science PR as a term, so the institutional science communication. What do you think? How important is this for a researcher? Oh, you do?
So research on scientific papers, kind of review, and after we publish in an online newspaper about the topic, so this is a good transfer to scientific knowledge to order.
Okay, that's a good concrete example. Mm-hmm. Is it important to reach for a wider audience in your own personal life? Is anybody writing a blog, a scientific blog? Can you imagine in the future that you will start a blog that is for the public to popularize your results? Time is typically, an issue.
I'm not that good in this language, let's say. Mm-hmm. That is short and highlighting stuff with really short sentence or picture or like Facebook and so on. But I guess we can use all of them. But we don't have to all be involved in this kind of...
Of course, it's personal preference as well, and it depends on your motivation and why you decided to become a scientist. That will be one of the questions, why you want to do research. And I was thinking that I know of one blog that is a psychology blog, and that's something that I constantly use in my teaching, because I also teach a psychology student, bachelor's at the bachelor's level, and also early education students at the bachelor level. And then, of course, it's English classes, but we do use scientific articles, and we do analyze scientific articles. And then sometimes I choose even blog entries, because those are a little bit easier to understand for them. And there is actually one blog that I keep getting back to, is the Psy blog. That's the name. I don't know if you have heard. And it's actually a psychologist who kind of synthesizes recently published articles in the field of psychology, and then there is always a short annotation that, of course, a full reference to the article, and then a short kind of summary for everyday audiences, I mean, everyday people in everyday language. And that's actually really, really interesting. And typically there is a topic, so a theme, and then many, many articles are listed related to that topic with a short description. So it's perfect for teachers like me, for example. Yeah.
And then I was wondering for Twitter, for example. I mean, it doesn't. Twitter is for scientists, for journalists, or people that are already involved or interested in it, but not for parents or.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Twitter could be used for many things. It's not the most typical channel, of course, for this kind of communication, but it could also be used. But have you heard of Twitter during conferences? When the public can already, that's actually a good sign of involving the public. And actually, you as a researcher, I think it's always interesting to listen to what the public has to say, because that kind of feedback is really meaningful and can maybe even spark some ideas in you. You never know. Feedback, any kind of feedback is, even if it's coming from non-experts, it could be useful and beneficial. So that's one big advantage of using these. Okay, let's move on to the democratic school. And as the name suggests, it's about equal rights. So when we are talking about the access to knowledge, of course, there are different differences between different countries as well. And actually, this is probably the biggest stream within the open science discourse, because it involves the open data and the open access. You probably all know what these mean. And of course, it's beneficial not only for the researchers, but for everybody technically involved. And the open data is something that you're going to go into more detail in the following presentation, so I don't really need to go into detail here. But if you think about data, then of course, depending on the research approach, qualitative, quantitative, or mixed, data can also involve texts, typically numerical data, but even multimedia software, any kind of data open data refers to any kind of data, and of course, different types of data. I just put some, but there are, of course, way more that you could think about. And then there is this phrase, open notebook science, which actually means that it's not only data that should be made public, but also the associated documentation. Is this common in psychology? That you share your, not necessarily, but even lab notes, field notes, diaries, transcripts, audio tapes. Is it common in psychology? Why not? What is the biggest obstacle or the biggest issue? Ethical issues, of course. Privacy, ethical issues, technically. It could also be security issues in certain other fields. So, of course, you need to take these into consideration. But as long as it doesn't have any obstacles, then actually, it can help researchers if they have access not only to the final data set, but also other, the process of research. Yeah?
Typically, these kind of data is so unorganized that it's a massive amount of time to make some meaning out of this type of data for other researchers.
Yeah, that makes sense. And of course, it depends on what kind of data we are talking about as well. So in different fields, it's probably easier to share these kinds of data, in certain other fields.
Can I comment? Are you sharing, or are you helping your PhD students to share their notes between generations of your PhD students?
We're trying to make some efforts, but perhaps not enough. So
That's a good point, actually, that within...
Inspirational notes from you in your
lecture. That's a good point, actually, that within a research group or within a department or something that can be a smaller scale data sharing, not necessarily to the public. Yeah, you can discuss this further. But you never know what other people can benefit from your data, even if it's disorganized. If you put comments, or descriptions. But anyway. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, that probably you're going to discuss this in more. Okay, some of the barriers and some of the benefits, I think we touched upon these. And actually, I want to emphasize the researchers' reluctance to share data, one of the barriers. Apparently, some research into this particular issue revealed that researchers typically don't share data just because they are altruistic, you know, they want to do some good, but also because they expect something in return. So the higher the expected benefit is, the more willing researchers are to share their data. So maybe it even matters who the person who wants your data is. I don't know. So there are many, many different things. But it's interesting that there is this, you know, exchange in return. It's very interesting. But of course, there are certain benefits. You can discuss this in more detail. And then, of course, I wanted to say that the mechanisms and strategies that can promote data sharing and open data is the policies of academic institutions, journals, funding agencies. And as far as I know, the Academy of Finland now, of course, depending on the type of data, from fully open to strictly confidential, it varies, but they require that you also have a publication plan and a data management plan included in your research plan. And also, I think it's a requirement that you need to deposit the data, am I right, in a repository. Is that correct? Or not necessarily? Okay, maybe not. I don't actually know too much about the Academy of Finland's requirements, but as far as I know, the Horizon, so the EU program, has this sentence. It's copy-pasted from their website, as open as possible and as closed, I mean, related to the data, as open as possible and as closed as necessary. So they do encourage researchers, as long as it's possible, to share data. And then there are these, of course, the UCS, that's a repository that's not about data sharing, but that's about when you publish your research, and then you can also self-archive a copy of your article, let's say, or your dissertation in their repository. And then, of course, there are also data repositories. I just listed some, but you don't necessarily need to go into detail. One of them, this the European Open Science Cloud, which is a project in progress, is a really interesting one because they are trying to create a platform for even including data sharing. I don't know if you have heard. I was surprised when I saw that there are actually so concrete initiatives to promote data sharing, at least at the European level and probably also at the global level. And also in Finland, there are certain platforms. This is something that you will discuss, so probably I don't need to go into detail, but these are issues that you need to consider when you do research, but you can go into more detail later. So, and then the other stream within the democratic school is the open access. And then, of course, this is the biggest problem today. Probably that's why even Aaron Schwartz started his actions, so to say, because there are the subscription journals, you all know what it is, and then, of course, the difference between developing and developed countries in terms of access to data can be a problem. And then, do you know of any concrete initiatives recently that try to change the current situation? Some kind of movement? In certain countries, at least, that were trying to actually boycott certain publishers. Have you heard? I don't want to name publishers because publishers are changing, so their policies is getting better and better, more and more open, I would say. But I know that in Finland also there was a movement. Many researchers joined, maybe even you. I don't know. So they were trying to protest against this policy, the subscription packages that are offered by publishers, and they say that it's not really fair. So, and they actually achieved at least some success. As far as I know, many of the publishers are now changing their policies. And then again, this open access mandate, the Academy of Finland, at least they do have this requirement that you have to publish in. Am I right? Or it's not a requirement, just a recommendation?
It's a requirement.
Requirement now. Okay, so you need to publish in an open access. Oh yeah, it's mandatory. In an open access journal. And then, of course, the routes for open access could be different. They do encourage the gold, but the green is also accepted. the difference between these roads. The gold road is the best when you publish in an open access journal that is fully open access. Of course, you need to check the quality of that particular journal. There is that link, the Sherpa, Romeo database, where you can actually see also journals and publishers' self-archiving policies. That's a bit different, sorry. But anyway, the green road is something that is also an optional one if you publish in a non-open access journal, but you self-archive later after publication, self-archive the article. So you publish it in an open access archive, and then you can actually check the publishers and the journal requirements, which version can you upload and where. Have you ever done that? Yeah, if it's open access, if it's an open access journal, then there are no restrictions, Creative Commons license, you can do whatever you want. But if it's from a non-open access journal, because sometimes you need to pay a fee to publish it open access, that's the hybrid version also, and then you need to check which version of the article you can upload to certain sites. Some publishers or journals allow the preprint, some allow the postprint. So you need to check if you don't want to make anything illegal, at least. And then again, the question of the hybrid open access. So if you pay the article processing charge, then again, the question is how democratic it is. Have you ever chosen that option? Because as far as I know, you have published, some of you have already published articles. Were they in an open access? So the gold? Uh-huh. Okay, that's good. That's a good sign, at least. Yeah. You can choose that option, yeah, in a subscription journal. And those fees, I think, vary quite a lot from journal to journal, so there are big differences between the article processing fee. And then, actually, this is a list of, at least in the best possible scenario, the gold route, the components of open access. As you can see, it includes the reader's rights, reuse rights, copyright, author posting rights, automatic posting to institutional or other trusted third-party repositories, or the machine readability that we already mentioned. So it doesn't just mean that it's open to the public, but many other things are involved in the open access. And according to some latest research, 28% of the scholarly literature today is open access, according to PivoWar 2018, and also a similar research, the European Commission came to the same conclusion, adding up the gold and the green numbers around roughly the same number, 28.3%. And actually, this link is really interesting. This Open Science Monitor, they update it regularly, and you can even see the open access situation in different countries. And I think I have a slide here. Probably you can't see anything. Number one is Switzerland, Croatia, Estonia, Belgium, Luxembourg. Finland is somewhere a little bit more down, but of course it changes, and this is actually, the reference date is 2018 April, the end of April, so it's pretty recent. But I think if they do the same, I don't know, a year later, it's going to be totally different. So this is a really recent phenomenon. And you can see that still it's the green route that is more popular than the gold route, but of course the situation is different in, let's say, in Estonia, it's almost half-half. The second one on the chart. So if you want interesting statistics, you can check the Open Science Monitor, because they also have similar statistics for different fields. So which fields are the most open in terms of open access publication? It's always interesting to see that. And then, of course, when you choose the open access journals, you need to check carefully what kind of journals. There is an association, the Open Access Scholarly Publishers Association, and the members need to adhere to a code of conduct, so it's a very professional association. And all the journals that are quality controlled are included in this DOAJ database, the directory of open access journals. So you can always check if the journal is here, but probably in your own country you also have lists of reliable open access journals. I just put there that there is that blog, for example, the Psychology Open Access Journal. It's a psychologist with a PhD, her blog, and he also regularly updates the list of open access journals. So actually, this is also something that you can do on your blog. I don't know, to check out the, it's your own judgment, of course, certain journals in your field. Okay. The benefits of publishing open access, probably you all know, not just to comply with open access mandates, so not just because it's compulsory, but also because you have more visibility. According to research, actually, articles that are published open access are more highly cited. So this is definitely, it's worth it. So the impact of your research, because the impact of your research, of course, counts if you think about your academic career, so it does matter. More efficient, and then of course you have the copyright, especially if you choose the gold route. Immediately you can reuse it, you can contribute to society, societal good, and all these things. And I would like to emphasize again the ongoing feedback through social media, because if people talk about your research, not necessarily scientists, but even or not necessarily scientists in your field, but from other fields, might have really good ideas and good points. So it's worth reading the feedback if you post it in any social media website, let's say. And then the pragmatic school, as the name suggests, it's all about making research more effective. And of course, there is a lot of overlap between these schools. So this overlaps with the instrumental school, that is about the tools and the online environment. But if you think about collaborative research, because collaboration means that research becomes more effective, definitely. That's one of the reasons to collaborate, and also shared expertise, of course. But if you think about the co-authoring, co-authored articles are quite common nowadays, and I would even dare to say that it's more common than single authored articles, but of course it depends on the field. Probably in psychology it's still single authorship that is typical. No? Even philosophy. I always cite philosophy. Probably in philosophy it's still the single author, but that's just my view. I think in psychology I know that it's the multiple authors. What do you think about co-authoring an article from the writer's perspective? This is going to one of the discussion questions. Have you encountered any difficulty? Do you think it's easier or more difficult? Yeah, the feedback. And typically, I think, I don't know, it varies from research group to research group, of course, but probably you share some of these. So somebody is working on the data analysis, somebody is working on the actual writing, somebody is working on some other things. But if you think about the overall result, which is the article, it has to be really coherent and really something that everybody shares. Also the style of writing, and I'm a language teacher, so I always get back to that, because sometimes that could be a problem, that the reader notices slight differences between different sections, because it's hard to make it coherent in style, so to say, because writing is a style. Is it common also that you language check? So there is there are language services that can check the article and edit. Because this is also something some researchers argue, that it's a sign that language and content are still separate. Because we think about, you write an article because of the content mainly, and the language is just the channel of communication, because you need to use language to express your ideas. There is no other way. But the problem is that as a language teacher, I know how much it matters, the way you use language. And then we can discuss it in the other presentation, the dissertation writing, how much it matters, how you use language. So actually, your own style is important. And I was also, I usually use this metaphor for my students, that if you think about artists, can you imagine co-painting? That would be really difficult. I don't say it's impossible, but that kind of illustrates the issue of, from the language use perspective, that it's really difficult. It's like a patchwork, especially if your language skills are at different levels, of course, because even the way you express the ideas, especially in the discussion section, whoever writes the discussion section, conclusion section, has the biggest responsibility probably to make it as clear as possible. And that's where the perspectives of the author, because what if your own, you know, views, perspectives are slightly different when you, for example, interpret the data? Yeah?
So if I think about Rembrandt as a great painter, I think that at a certain point he was not mixing his own paint anymore. He had a servant who makes his paint.
Really?
The servants did not get to sign the painting that Rembrandt made, but they didn't.
That's interesting, did not know.
The challenge that I see nowadays with science is that science is getting more and more complex. Authorship, the idea of authorship as contributing to a scholarly work. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So that people can contribute in other ways than to the text, but still contribute to the final.
Yeah, that is definitely. That's why I emphasize that I'm talking about from the language perspective, but of course contribution can be, yeah, and that definitely has to be acknowledged. I just know that sometimes when I read articles, if the article is not checked by a professional language editor, it can happen that it gets published, and then you can feel slight differences in style between different sections. When I could easily say when the article was edited by a professional language or when it was not. But also it's a little strange because, you know, if you give your work to a professional editor, then it means that you don't consider language to be part of your own work. But I think it is. It is. So that's why, actually, I would love, but we can get into more details. Because I think that language, the way you use language does affect the way you express the ideas, so the content. So they are related. So ideally, it's the author who checks the language, but of course, again, time and other issues come into play. Okay. Then the infrastructure school, just very briefly, as the name suggests, information and communication technologies. And as I say, this is at the heart of all the other four schools because everything is depending now. Everything depends on the internet now, different tools, collaboration tools, and even making research. This distributed computing, of course, it's more common in certain other fields where large-scale data-intensive projects are more typical. Good example is this open science grid. So even the research itself can be done by connecting computers, so using the power of technology, so to say, but also the collaboration aspect, as we said. How many of you are in this ResearchGate or academia or Mendeley? Most of you, probably. Uh-huh. What is the biggest advantage, or what are you using these sites for, mainly? Sorry? Networking, okay. Oh, accessing full text even, yeah. Uh-huh. What did you want?
I mainly use it because you can export them in a big text file and it's very easy to reference.
Okay, which one, the Mendeley?
Yep.
Yeah, Mendeley is actually improving also, so it's really, really useful for many other things, not just networking. Yeah, so this is common, but of course, multi-purpose social networking sites could also be used even for purposes of networking or anything. I actually found this Center for Open Science. I don't know if you know about it. I just accidentally found it, and I don't know anything about the quality of this. They have actually programs, this Open Science Framework. It's a it's a platform that you can use, and it combines, for example, Mendeley is one of them, integrated in it, Google Drive, Cloud, so all the most useful basic tools are integrated into one. Have you heard of it? You can check it out, but I don't really know how it works. I should have checked it out. I saw a picture that it integrates at least 22 of the basic tools that people use, and I think it's still in its infancy, so they are developing it. You might want to check it out and see if it's useful for you. And then the last one is the measurement school, and I think this is a very important strand because it's about how you can measure impact, the impact of your research. We mentioned the scientific and the socio or even socioeconomic impact. You can see how impact can manifest itself, not just useful for researchers, but also society. Also, you can influence policy making. You can even create a useful product, so a concrete product or a service. New technology could be developed. Even new jobs could be created using your results. Even new companies, you never know. And then, again, this is related to the writing of the dissertation, when, especially at the end, where you have to emphasize what are the implications and what is the impact, the contribution of your research to different areas. Then you can actually specify not just the scientific impact, but also how it impacts society in a more broader sense. And, of course, you know the traditional metrics, especially the impact factor. We can discuss it a little bit more. And also sometimes the individual author, so the level of the author, typically the age index, is something that they measure. And if you know the term altmetrics, probably you have heard, technically they want to measure impact from a broader perspective, including not just the scientific impact, but also the societal impact. And then if you look at the examples, unpublished works, tweets, blogs, followers, discussions, bookmarks, download, they all count. Somehow they are all signs of impact in a way. So the proponents of the altmetrics argue that they should be also included when measuring the impact of a particular article or a particular author as well. So it's the whole process of research, actually. And you know the impact factor. Do you actually take it into consideration quite a lot? Because you know how it's measured, the number of citations to any type of content, and it's important to emphasize that any kind of article, there are different types of articles, by any journal, only the ones that are indexed in the Web of Science, typically over the previous 2 years, but in some fields they also use the three or five-year impact, divided by the number of only original articles and only review articles. So it's a little interesting that in B, they only count the original research articles and review articles, nothing else. And then actually, here you can see there are some things that we need to take into consideration when we analyze the impact factor, because first of all, it only calculates citations from those journals that are in the Web of Science, which is okay. But it might be that the journal is new, I don't know, you never know. And also the high impact factor doesn't necessarily mean that the article is good, because notorious articles or even retracted articles are typically highly cited, which will, of course, be reflected by the impact factor. And also a small number of highly cited articles can skew the figure, because then the impact factor measures the average number of articles. So if there are, two really highly cited articles in that journal, that can influence the overall impact factor of the journal. And then review articles that are, in every field it's important, but those are typically heavily cited. So some journals that are dedicated to publishing review articles, of course, typically have higher impact factors compared to other journals. New journals that have little or no citation, of course, their impact factor is not, or doesn't even exist. And also, citing articles previously published in the same journal can skew the figure. I don't know if I should make that comment or not, but apparently, according to some research, some editors encourage the authors to cite articles published in the same journal. But I don't know, I don't want to judge any journal because I don't actually know how it happens, but that could be an issue. Or if you think about the peer reviewers, when they give the review, they might actually recommend certain, to cite certain articles that were published because they know that it will affect the impact factor of the journal. So there are certain things that you need to take into consideration, and of course the different disciplinary practices, because for example in mathematics, even old articles are typically cited, whereas in probably in psychology, especially if it's empirical research, you cite the most recent articles more than others. So it's difficult to compare the impact factors across disciplines. So within a discipline it's okay, but not across disciplines. And then the several authors to one paper, the issue of self citations is also something that can affect the impact factor. And then I said this PLOMx is probably the most popular metrics, concrete one. Elsevier actually bought it in 2017, so now this is used in Mendeley, which is also was purchased by Elsevier, and also in Scopus, so they used PLOMx, the alt metrics, so to measure different impacts. Ways, signs of impact, usage, captures, mentions, social media, and citations. And in the citations, you can see it's not just the traditional citations, but also patent citations, clinical, if it's cited in clinical guidelines, that also counts, or even in certain policies, policy reports. So I think this gives quite a broad idea of what altmetrics measure. And then one more thing that I wanted to discuss, the peer review process at certain journals, that is also a measure of impact. And there has been a lot of criticism against the traditional peer review process. Of course, there is the double-blind, single-blind, probably you know these. And then some journals, especially open access journals, have adopted this open peer review, which means that both the reviewer or reviewers and the author are known to each other. They know who the reviewer is, the reviewer know who the author is. Of course, there are positives and negatives, so benefits and drawbacks. Probably if you read them, you can agree. I would agree to almost all of the positives and the negatives as well. So this is a very debated issue. Would you ever publish in a journal that uses open review, open peer review? Mm-hmm. Again, transparency. If you know that what you're doing is good quality, then you don't have anything to hide, then this is not an issue. From the reviewer's perspective, I don't know, the negatives that the reviewers might tone down their criticism. I don't know if they know that the author knows that it's them, so it might affect the quality of the peer review, might not. So this actually is it's a good research topic, I think. I don't know if there is research into that or not, but that would be a good one, important one. And then there is this interesting phenomenon of post-publication peer commentary. Again, some open access journals have adopted this practice. It means that after you publish the article in the journal, there is a platform where actually users, typically experts from the field, comment on the published paper. And this is, again, a good source of feedback. But it could also be non-expert, technically, so that's a big advantage of the... So it's not really peer review in the traditional sense, it's peer in the sense that it's non... I mean, not the reviewers themselves. Okay, and this is something that you will probably go into more detail in the next presentation, some things that you need to consider when you think about integrating open science in your research workflow. But let's not go into detail because I know that you will discuss that. And then these are the questions. The timing was pretty good. So I would like you to get into, I don't know, small groups or maybe even pairs is fine. So somebody sitting next to you and discuss these questions. And then hopefully we will have time. Maybe 10 minutes before the end, I can ask you. And if you have anything interesting to share, it would be nice if you shared what you have discussed, so feel free. And if you don't have anybody sitting next to you, feel free to move, at least. Some of them we have already discussed partly, but you can still go into more detail. detail. You can be three also if you want, yeah. Drop here. All right. Since we have 10 minutes left, is it okay if you share some of the thoughts? Do we need to do that?
I'm writing it down. I am at 8.
8. Or is there any question that you felt that you talked a little bit more about? Which particular number?
7.
Number 7? Okay. I think that is a very important question. So what we can discuss briefly number 7, because it is important. It is important. And I'm curious, actually, what are the different motivations? Because probably you have many. What was yours, if it's public? Because I know that if I tell you my personal example, when I first thought about the PhD, the first push was because, at least in Hungary, there was this requirement that everybody working in a university needs to have a PhD. So that was something that you need to do it. And then, you know, what kind of PhD? And then, of course, you start to look around what interests you most and then which one is the most relevant for your job. But the very first external push was this particular thing. But, of course, I was always thinking about it, so it's not just the external push, but what?
Maybe it was a strategic move. Strategic move,
uh-huh.
Well, yeah, I mean, after my path, yeah, I mean, I did study neuroscience and then I I asked for suggestions from my supervisors at the time and decided that was the best thing to do, though I was sure that I wouldn't have followed that path afterwards.
And how do you think this question relates to open science? Why did I put it there?
Working to, I'm gonna perceive like this is a community. I'm gonna do my best to share.
Yeah, even the share, and you really want to change something. And if you are really motivated, then you think about the societal impacts. That's why I actually, because if somebody just wants to do it because it looks cool, or I don't know what other motivations there might be, then it's not gonna be the best. What about collaboration between fields? I don't know which one it is. Number 6, because these particular projects already include many different disciplines. Can you think of collaboration project between something very far-fetched, between...
Well, actually,
I think everything is related.
This group is a very good example.
Which one?
This group, the other group, is a very good example because we all come from very, very different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of backgrounds?
Well, I'm a physicist.
Okay.
Also some psychologists, some data analysts, engineers. And I think we all like try to approach the same problem, but from different perspectives, and I think that's something very good.
Different disciplinary perspectives are really, really valuable. It's still undervalued how much you can learn from anybody, yeah? That is true. You mentioned many, many challenges actually related to that. So we can actually get back to that tomorrow when we discuss the writing itself. Yeah.
I also think that it helps in translating what you're doing in other perspective, because, for example, if you are more of an engineer, you will see more the technical part. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you won't see the more global aim and what will be the interest for other fields, for example. I think working with other disciplines, it helps getting this problem.
There is this metaphor you might have heard, and I have no idea where it comes from. Sorry, I can't cite anybody. When you look at, you know, there is a big board, and there is a hole in it, and then you look at the phenomenon, and there is, let's say, you can see an ear going to a certain direction, and then you can see another ear going the other direction, and then you see a tail, and then you come up with all kinds of rules that, I don't know, if you see an ear, 5 seconds later you will see a tail, and then the rules are there. But you don't know, or you don't see, that it's actually a cat. And this whole, I think, might represent even disciplinary perspectives. So if you broaden the hole, you might be able to see the cat. Sorry, it's a stupid example, but I think it illustrates the problem of this, because disciplinary points of views are sometimes very narrow, I think, and that can restrict or prevent you from seeing the whole. Yeah. Any other questions that you would like to comment on or discuss?
Another issue we were discussing here is where one of the biggest problems about data sharing is where you draw the line between this is confidential.
Yeah,
this is,
especially in newer.
And then I can share this because this is data or experiment-related information. Because well, sometimes in behavioral experiments, it's very hard because what you can share is sensitive information. Because I don't know if it's, for example, a dyslexic test or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. But of course, who you are sharing it with is another thing, because it's not shared, not all the data is shared with everybody or especially with the public, but within smaller circles, as you said, that's an issue that you have to think about, probably you're going to cover.
Yeah.
Yep.
We'll
yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? We are approaching the end.
I have one.
Yeah. Depends on the journal.
Okay.
This is actually not so common, the open peer review,
yeah.
for obvious reasons. Yeah, double blind or single blind, those are the typical. When you were actually publishing the paper, did you know about the peer review, the type of peer review?
You can suggest.
You can check when you, yeah. That's also a common.
Yeah, I don't know who accepts.
Yeah, that's an interesting practice when you as the author have to suggest.
Yeah,
so when they are trying to let you cite some paper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it happened.
If you can have a guess or who it is.
Yeah, there is actually research on how open even the single or the double-blind peer review process is, and they say that even the reviewers can guess, first of all. Sometimes it's easy, especially if it's a restricted area, but also they have, like, is it a male person or a female person, even young, experienced, inexperienced, so they always have some guesses, and probably those are pretty accurate, but I don't know, actually. Can you imagine, by the way, doing peer review, so for a journal, doing peer review work? What do you think are the benefits?
To read a lot of literature.
Yeah? Mm. Okay. You will know the most recent trends, probably, or ideas, yeah? Well, again, this is a controversial issue. Let's not discuss that. But,
no, I mean,
yeah.
You give advice, you can broaden. Maybe there are things in the data that you didn't look into, and they will give, I mean, they
yeah.
will improve the quality of the paper. I mean, that's the idea, right?
Yeah. You can learn a lot.
Supposed to
yeah, probably you know that when you start teaching, that's when you learn a lot. So technically doing peer review or even in your group, if you just read each other's papers, comment, that's a learning process for you also. So that I do advise to take it seriously because you can benefit a lot. All right. If no other questions, then let's go and eat. Thank you for your attention, and then we are going to meet tomorrow also to discuss writing-related issues. And thank you.